where there are trees, open space, clean air, countryside, a chance for people to be people instead of being herded around by other men and machines. And it doesn't seem sometimes to be something quite as dramatic as an international crisis, but ladies and gentlemen, you cannot have a peaceful, respectful, law-abiding society if you have people jammed together like cattle in overcrowded cities. We've got to have living space, room to live, and we are determined to help attain it. I think that program deserves your support. And then we ought to be well aware of two other things. Any country and any government that's worth respect is one that will provide opportunity for its young and security for its elderly. I might add a third dimension, compassion and care for its needy and disabled. And this administration is determined that never again will our elderly be the forgotten ones. There was a time, dear friends, that we shunted aside those who were the victims of mental disorder. They were put away in institutions and forgotten. It was a crime, a sin. Finally, we woke up and we started to do something about it, and we remembered that these too were children of God. They were entitled to love and to care. Now what are we doing? In this fast-moving country of ours, this technology that changes so much, all too often we permit our elderly in many a community to be pushed aside in the third floor tenement, forgotten. Let them live on a little pension, inadequate for clothing, food, and rent. But worst of all, nothing for them to do. The unbelievable, sordid existence of loneliness. This administration is not afraid to be compassionate. We do not believe that being compassionate means that you're a socialist. We do not believe that taking care of the unfortunate means that you're a coward or weak. We believe that the strong have an obligation to the weak and the suffering. And we believe that the rich also have an obligation to the needy. And without destroying those who are strong or rich, we're going to make it our business to see that America, above all, is just and compassionate, and that it's good to those that have lived out their 65 years, and those that come into this earth to grace us as children. This we're going to do. Yes, there will be housing. Yes, there will be Medicare. Yes, there'll be these things without in any way destroying incentive, but in fact giving people greater incentives. So let me ask you these questions tonight. Without telling you what we ought to do, let me ask you to figure out for yourself the answers to these questions. Can we have a great society as long as millions of our people live in grinding poverty through lack of training? As long as jobs are denied for no good reason but because of the color of a man's skin? As long as doors are closed to immigrants because of where they happen to be born? As long as some of our citizens are denied the right to vote? You think we can have a great society and permit those conditions to exist? The Johnson administration, your administration, has made proposals to the Congress in 1965 which will move towards righting these wrongs. These proposals, I submit, deserve your support. Oh, I know what the critics say. They say, well, look at here, Mr. Vice President, you haven't moved nearly enough. Some say we haven't gone far enough, and some say, oh my goodness, look what they're doing now. I just want to remind this audience tonight, dear friends, that the most important step that anyone takes is the first step. It's the beginnings that count. And the longest journey in your life is the first step. The most important decision in your life is the first decision. And this administration doesn't say to the American people that we're going to guarantee everyone the good life. It doesn't say to the American people that in these 4 years we'll right all these wrongs. What it says to the American people is that we're going to try to provide for the American people an opportunity for themselves to gain the good life. And what we also say is that while we know we cannot overcome the wrongs in one administration or even one decade, that to wait another day is to deny the truth of the facts. And we're not going to wait. We're going to start. These proposals reach out to our hearts, and these wrongs reach out to our hearts. Do we believe that men are created equal, or do we just mouth it? Is it merely something to recite for our youngsters and for those that gather on patriotic occasions? Do we immigrants, and we all are, or at least we're sons and daughters of immigrants, do we still offer welcome to those who would come to America to build a better life? Are we more interested about where you come from than rather who you are and what you are? Our laws sometimes so indicate. And this administration is going to right that wrong too. We're not going to have any second-class citizenship in this country, and we're not going to have any second-class people in our laws. We're going to revise the immigration laws of America so that they're just and fair and decent. And then there is education. The story of education is the story of our country. No people knows that better than the people of Connecticut. The first colleges in America here, the first schools. No people in the world believe in broad excellence in education any more than we do. Education is our only guarantee of security at home and abroad. At least security in the world and welfare at home. From the time that our nation was founded until 1930, which is only a few years ago, less than 1 million students had been enrolled in American colleges. From the birth of this nation, from the early 1600s to 1930, 300 years, less than 1 million men and women had ever been enrolled in a college. Now we enroll over 1 million every 2 years. And my dear friends, we're going to start enrolling as many as 1 million every year. We will have to build more college classroom space between now and 1975 in 10 years than we built in 300. We have no choice. This we must do. But even so, some of our finest young men and women are not getting to college. And this is the waste of all wastes. The wisest investment that a business community can ever make is education. The wisest investment that a nation can ever make for its future is in education. It is only the nation that is educated that will survive. And the stories of destruction and despair and failure will be written in the nations where education was neglected. There's a terrible tragedy in this no education program that we've had all too often. May I just say here, digressing for a moment, there isn't any real chance for true civil rights until people have education. There isn't any such thing as real equal opportunity for a job until you're trained for it. You can't even have a job today in the most menial type of occupation without some form of education. And we're paying a terrible price in our cities for separate but equal. We're paying a terrible price in America today for the failure to educate. a price of violence and disorder and of unemployment, of social trouble. We spend about $450 a year per pupil on our young people. We spend $1,800 a year to keep a delinquent in a detention home. We spend $2,500 a year for a family on relief. And we spend $3,500 a year for an inmate in a state prison. $450 for an education. $3,500 in prison. $1,800 for every juvenile delinquent. Each delinquent averages up for a total on your tax bill of $25,000 a year. It costs more per year for a school dropout than it does to give him 4 years of high school education. Those are hard, cold economic facts. And our schools are overcrowded and there's a population growing. So President Johnson has said, let's get busy. Let's do something about it. Let's see the children, regardless of race, color, or creed, that they have books, that they have pencils, that they have facilities. Let's stop some of these arguments that we've had for years. Let's think of the child. Let's think of the boy and the girl, the brain power, the talent that's going to waste. And we're going to hear a lot of talk in Congress about a lot of things that really don't count. What's most important for America right now is to see to it that the uneducated are educated. To see to it that every boy and girl in America shall enjoy a right and a privilege that every American should have, namely the best education that the richest country on the face of the earth can provide. Now, I know that I'd be negligent here tonight if I didn't ask your support for one final cause. Which is the final cause? Because if this war is plunged into a war, if this world should become involved in a nuclear holocaust, all that we've talked about will be for naught. But I ask you to remember what that great man Abraham Lincoln said in his second inaugural. While he asked us to remember, almost in prayer, with malice towards none, and with charity for all, he also said, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right. You are not a lover of freedom or a defender of it by ignoring its assassins. And you do not guard the temple of freedom by letting people tear it down stone by stone. But likewise, may I say that you do not build the world of peace by the wishing for it. Peace itself is like a cathedral. It requires many, many years of loving effort and care. The great cathedrals of the world have been the product of centuries, of family after family and generation after generation. And peace, like a cathedral, will require that patience, that perseverance, that dedication, that sacrifice. I think it's a good analogy. Because a great religion or a great temple or a great cathedral doesn't come without care and without dedication, nor do you preserve it. Now we hear many people today saying that America is overextended in the world, that we're trying to do far too much. And each is entitled to his point of view. And we hear others that say that these problems of other people, they're not really our problems. And you hear others that say that we ought to close up shop overseas and enjoy our fruits right back here in the good old USA. Just like you hear some people say, why should we defend freedom 7,000 miles away? Chamberlain said that once. Why defend it in the Sudetenland? Why defend it in Austria? Why not go to Munich? Haven't we learned something? Has all of this tragedy, all of this sorrow, all of this unbelievable, costly expense been for naught? Haven't we learned by now that you cannot run away from responsibility? That is, if you want to be a leader. Now, if you just want to be nothing, if you just want to get along, if you just want to be soft, immoral, amoral, a nothing, a weakling, then you can run away from responsibility. But you can't, on the one hand, speak of us as the home of the brave and speak of America as the leading power in the world and then act like a coward or ignore responsibility. These are the decisions that face us tonight in Vietnam, in the Middle East, in Central Europe, everywhere. And we can't run away. So I ask these questions. Who in the world will work for democracy if we do not? Who's going to stand up for freedom if the strongest is weak and afraid? Who in the world can set the example, can offer the needed hand, if we do not? We live in a time when everything is tough and complex. We live in a time when there are no rapid or easy answers, except from people that don't know what they're talking about. We live in a time when we're being tested, when we need not only patience, but perseverance, when we need to be firm, as well as being understanding. The question is, have we the patience for leadership? Have we the patience, for example, to work and to bleed several thousand miles from Hartford tonight? Not for just tonight, but for months, maybe. Have we the courage to take on this burden of world leadership for years? Or do you want to turn it over to somebody else? Because I think we in this party and we as Americans above all need to recognize that there will be a guiding force in this world. And if we are unwilling to accept the mantle of leadership, someone else will pick it up. And that someone else will not be a free people or a free government. And all of our riches and all of our vaunted power will be meaningless. The price of leadership is sacrifice. I can tell you that the forces of totalitarianism have patience. They're waiting for us to give up. They're waiting for us to fail. And that is what the Great Society is all about. The patience, the leadership, the courage, the willingness to sacrifice if need be and suffer. It is a recognition that a second car and power mowers and dry martinis are not enough for greatness. It is a recognition that we stand for something not seen before in this world. We stand for dignity, for fulfillment of every individual man and woman. We stand for the chance for each person to make something better of himself. And we stand for peace without conquest, and peace without cowardice. And we stand for the belief that others too, in less fortunate places, should have the opportunity for the blessings of abundance and should have a chance to be free from tyranny. We stand for the pledges made by men and women who left the old ways and fought, yes, dug out a living out of the soil of this new continent. These, my fellow Americans, are our commitments. That's why we're in politics. That's why you elect senators. That's why you participate, not just to win an election. No longer is it a game. Our responsibilities are awesome. The tasks ahead are almost incredible and unbelievable. And I come to this audience not only to praise a great senator and a fine and great governor. I come here to enlist your help. We cannot achieve the great society, nor can we lead the world in peace, in freedom, and security, unless our people understand. And you have to be the advocates. You have to be the tribunes of the people. You, first of all, must understand. Because you gave the leadership to this country. You elected President Lyndon Johnson. You elected a Democratic Congress. You're a part of this government. You cannot wash your hands of it. And this government is committed to a program of progress at home. A program of opportunity for every human being in America. A program of equal rights for every person, regardless of race, color, or creed. This administration has declared war not only on poverty, but upon bigotry and upon discrimination. And this administration has pledged itself to work for a just and an enduring peace in this world with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right. Thank you.